Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 580. My name is Camden Busey, and I serve as the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church up in Grays Lake, Illinois. And we have some of our friends, our regulars, back with us today to talk about the theology and all things pertaining to that. We have with us first Jim Cassidy, who serves as pastor of South Austin OP in South Austin, Texas. Hey, Jim, how are you? You're muted.
How are you? Boy, we're starting out stellar today, aren't we? I'm great. How about yourself?
Great. I thought you might be coming back with a Spanish accent or something. Jim's fresh on the heels of a trip to Colombia, South America.
I did learn a little Spanish, but no accent.
Un poco? Sí. Well, I'm going to be there in about a month, so I'm going to pick your brain. Jim and I have not had the opportunity to debrief after his trip, so we're going to talk about some of those things today a little bit, talk about his class. He taught an entire class on Cornelius Van Til and the Reformation of Apologetics. But before we talk about some things like that, we also have with us Glenn Clary. Glenn serves as pastor of Providence OP in Pflugerville, Texas, just there in the Austin area. Welcome back, Glenn. It's great to talk to you as well.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be back.
Yes, it's good to have both of you brothers with us. As today we're going to be speaking about a range of subjects. Don't have a particular agenda other than a few topic ideas and things we want to discuss pertaining to some things that have been going on here at Reform Forum and some things we've been reading and working on. So it's fun once in a while just to take a break and not have a particular book to prep or a particular guest. We love doing that, but sometimes it's nice just to have an in-house conversation and see where it takes us. And often we end up in some interesting places. So I'm glad to have Jim and Glenn on with us today to talk about some of these matters. Just to catch up on a few things, I'd like for people to check us out online at reformedforum.org. You know all about what's going on there. At least I hope you do. You could visit us online and find out information about all of our programs. You can also find our store. There's always a ready stock of antiquarian books and some rarer Reformed stuff available on the store that Ryan Noah finds. He's got some stuff coming up soon. He's just told me about some new acquisitions, and it'll be nice to see what he puts into the store. If you ever want to find like a first edition copy of something by Van Til or Voss or all of our Reformed heroes, then reformedforum.org/store is the place to be. Also, if you head on over, you can still buy the copy or buy a hardcover copy of the new book, Your Heart is Voss, by Danny Olinger. And if you've purchased that book directly from the Reform Forum store, you're going to have some news coming in your email inbox in the future. So we're going to hopefully have a special event coming up about this book. And so stay tuned. If you purchase that book through us, take a look in your email inbox, and very soon you're going to find out some information about something coming up here in the month of February. I know I said February wrong, but sometimes I like to emphasize how it's spelled.
That poor little R is so neglected, you know.
Also Wednesday, not Wednesday. You know, you of all people must have some pretty fun ways to pronounce some of those words, Jim.
I try to eliminate as many letters as I can just to make sure it's short and sweet.
Yeah, you've received your fair share of flack on this program for the New Jersey accent, but it's all well and good. Of course, I don't think I have an accent, but then when I'm in Philadelphia, everyone says I have this very harsh Midwestern accent, so who knows? Who knows? It's certainly not the Boston accent, but somehow Jeff seemed to have shaken his New England accent over the years. But speaking of accents, Jim, you were just down, as I mentioned, down in Colombia, South America. Tell us about what was going on and tell me what's going to happen when I'm going down there with Doug Clawson. I'd love to hear it. Catch us up.
Yeah, it was a great trip. So I joined Brother Clawson as a representative of the Home Missions Foreign Missions Committee of the OPC, and we went down there to do a pastor's conference. It's an annual conference that we do at the church in Bogota, the OPC congregation in Bogota, called something Iglesia Raw, and that's the name of the church. I just call it the Raw Church for short. And the pastor there is Andreas Espinoza, and he is a wonderful brother in the Lord, doing really good work building the church there in Bogota. The church in Bogota is significantly larger than most OP congregations back here in the States. And it really is filled with some wonderful dear saints, people who made us feel very welcomed and who were attentive, who listened, and who asked some incredible questions. Anyhow, during the week, Tuesday through Friday, I had 4 hours of material to do each of those evenings, and answering questions and then delivering lectures. And the focus was on the Reformation of Apologetics. So Cornelius Van Til and the Reformation of Apologetics. And what I did was I tried to situate Van Til's approach to apologetics within his overall understanding of the ministry. And I begin with a quote by Alan Gelzo. When he met Van Til, he asked Van Til why it was that he had pursued all this education, why it was that he did PhD work, and why it is that he has written so many books and all this other stuff. And Van Til's answer was, why to protect Christ's little ones? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was incredibly telling. And that expression, by the way, the protection of Christ's little ones, appears in one form or another scattered throughout Van Til's writings. And so this isn't just sort of this personal off-the-cuff thing that he said in a private conversation. This is embedded within his thought.
And it's very Johannine. We're studying 1 John right now. It's very similar to some of the way John describes the church and the believers as little children.
Yes, as my little child. All right. Or you think about the exhortation that Jesus gives to Peter.
Feed my sheep, feed my lambs.
Feed my lambs. So what I do is I try to situate Van Til's approach to apologetics within his overall understanding of his ministry as a pastoral ministry, which is very different than the way in which many have and many tend to think of Van Til as mostly an academician or some sort of a brainy scholar who is involved in technical discussions, and he is involved in those technical discussions, and he did labor in the academy, but he understood his labor in the academy as one who is a servant of Jesus Christ, called to protect Christ's little ones. And so apologetics needs to be understood kind of in that context, that we're not talking about, Van Til didn't seek to develop a method of apologetics that would provide a club for people to use in order to kind of beat people up to beat atheists up in a debate, to get a gotcha move on them, to checkmate them, to change metaphors here a little bit. Although Van Til's approach to apologetics certainly does allow us to do that. But everything that Van Til did, including his polemics against those within even his own communion, his own Reformed fellowship, as Van Til was known to do, to level criticism against less consistent forms of Reformed theology, we would call this this polemics. As Van Til exercised and practiced polemics, it has to be understood against the backdrop not of a ornery personality or something like that. I mean, he was one of the most, kindly, friendly, gentle men you'll have ever met, according to the historical record. But his approach to polemics, he believes was a necessary pastoral ministry to which he was called in order to protect Christ's little ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, is this something that was really new? I mean, were you introducing Van Til to these Colombian brothers and sisters, I assume, for the very first time?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was for the very first time. They do have some resources translated in Spanish, but very, very little, very few resources. Bonson has a book, and I didn't catch the title of it because I couldn't read the Spanish. So, Richard Pratt's book, Every Thought Captive. And so they have some familiarity with presuppositionalism, particularly as it comes, from Bonson and such. So that's about it. But there are no works of Van Til's translated and published in Spanish, which is a shame.
That is a shame.
So, yeah, a lot of them aren't familiar with Van Til's thought particularly. But here's good news. One of the things that I tried to do in the conference was connect Van Til's thought to the thought of Gerhardus Voss. And Voss has, of course, his 5-volume Reform Dogmatics, which is available through Logos. But Logos also has a Spanish version of that available as well. So that was encouraging, because that was kind of an area where I was able to encourage people in terms of further reading. If you want to understand the theological backdrop of Van Til's thought, go ahead and start working your way through Voss's Reformed Dogmatics, because that's going to give you the exegetical, biblical, theological, and systematic theological backdrop to Van Til's thought.
So explain for us a bit of the church context. And I know Doug is really involved. Doug Clausen, as Jim mentioned, is Associate General Secretary for the Committee on Foreign Missions for the OPC, but he also serves as a board member of Reform Forum. And so we're good friends with Doug and do a lot of work with him. But one of Doug's main responsibilities, at least a thing he spends a lot of time on, is if I'm getting the title correct, is with this Mobile Theological Training Institute or Training Corps. And so the goal would be to train up officers in the church, in indigenous churches throughout the world. And he goes down to South America quite often and brings people with him to teach courses. So Jim was one of these to teach apologetics in about a month. I'm going down a little bit on short notice to fill a gap for the group to teach on Roman Catholicism, but I'm sure they're just going to teach me about it because the context being so unique in Central America and South America as well. But explain a bit about the relationship here between this church and the OPC and just the Reformed, worldwide communion, as it were. Is this an ICRC group? What are some of the details? Do you know them?
Yeah, so I know precious little, and I'm not sure that this is my understanding. So brothers in foreign missions and brothers down in Colombia who may listen to this, if I get my details wrong, I apologize, and please send us correspondence so we can correct the details. But my understanding is that there are two confessional conservative groups, Presbyterian groups there in Colombia. There's one that kind of identifies with the OPC, and then there's one that kind of identifies with the PCA, and both groups have been helped by PCA, OPC, respectively, back here at home. But the groups are relatively small, and I don't know if they're a part of the ICRC. I don't know what their technical fraternal status is, although certainly we have a very good working relationship, I understand, with both groups. And so it is a cooperative effort, recognizing that in Colombia, in terms of the religious representation that's there, it is overwhelmingly Roman Catholic, and then beyond
charismatic.
Roman Catholicism, charismatic and Pentecostal comes next, and then the Reformed.
The Catholicism's charismatic.
Yeah, that's right. There's charismatic and Pentecostal movements within Catholicism there, but that's here too in America. That's present as well. But anyhow, the Reformed faith is very. Very rare there. You do also have Reformed Baptist groups as well, but that's about it. And the rest is going to be broadly evangelical, non-denominational, and such. So the Reformed faith is a very small thing. But here's the good news: the way that I perceive it, I think that the Reformed faith is positioned in Colombia to continue to grow. I mean, I'm no prophet, never mind the son of a prophet, but it seems to me that the church is in a really good position to grow. They have some really good men and good brothers on the ground there. You know, Pastor Espinoza being one of them, particularly, who, in addition to pastoring this church, is very energetic. He also has sort of a fledgling institute that I think is called the Biblical Academy or something like that, or an Academy of the Bible. It has a full orbed curriculum that mirrors very similarly to what you find in a seminary curriculum. And what he does is he takes the classes that that Doug helps to formulate for the pastor's conference, and then Pastor Espinoza builds on top of that material and then turns it into a course that he plugs into the curriculum for the Biblical Academy.
That's cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. So he is, he's multi-gifted it. He's also taking courses here back in the States. What I understand is pursuing a THM back here. So he's continuing his education and things, just in terms of setting the more broad context. There was a time, as many people know who have been paying attention to popular media or whatnot, there was a time where Colombia as a nation was going through some really difficult times culturally.
to say the least, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was really...
It's been
really
tumultuous.
Mm-hmm. Now that has improved. This is my understanding, what I'm hearing secondhand, is that has improved dramatically. Politically, things are coming to a more peaceful position, which is helping the economy. And as you drive around Bogota, you know, you have some areas that are, you know, that seem to be less prosperous economically, and then other areas that are seem to be prospering economically. And there is the millennial generation, so to speak, seems to be a generation that is coming up through Colombia, which is very educated. They're finding and pursuing good jobs there in Colombia. The economy in certain sectors is getting stronger, it seems. And so education, economy, prosperity, and all of that is on the upswing. But again, so much of this depends on politics, and you know how politics can be. It's so volatile that it could change overnight, mm-hmm. and so you just don't know. But all of that seems to be good for the church, in terms of the church being able to have men who are positioned both economically and educationally to pursue higher education and to begin to solidify and establish the Reformed faith there.
Yeah.
Colombia. So
it's so helpful to hear about that and to be reminded of these things and to make friendships. I'm glad for your opportunity to go and to make friendships with people in a different country and then realize that we still share a common faith, and more than that, even in many ways, a common confession of that Catholic faith, small c Catholic. So I'm looking forward to experiencing that myself. But it's also encouraging to me to be reminded of how we view all of our different organizations and the different hats that we wear. You and I and Glenn as ministers in the OPC, all pastors of local congregations, and then Doug as a missionary who oversees the work of many missionaries, and then all of us as board members of a parachurch organization, Reform Forum, and then involved in various things with the Presbytery and the denomination, to think, you know, how all these, what's the economy of all this? And what are the roles and responsibilities of all of these different groups? And I'm very thankful for the leadership and the guidance of you brothers at Reformed Forum to help us to think how best we are situated to serve the church. And we're not a quasi-church organization. There are a lot of parachurches out there that function kind of in the place of the church or step on the toes of the church's rightful responsibility and authority. We merely seek to support the church, but how do we do that? Well, it's really a beautiful thing when we think about worldwide outreach. At least in our denomination, we consider all of our activities as a denomination to be under the large umbrella of what we call worldwide outreach. And then there are three main committees that function in different ways. There's the Foreign Missions Committee, which seeks to establish churches, indigenous churches in other countries that would be self-sustaining, self-propagating, and that in turn would have ecumenical fellowship with us and be able to send out their own missionaries to other countries. That's the goal, a very clear definition of what we are doing in foreign missions. And then home missions is the activities where we're seeking to plant churches where we already have established presbyteries. So you can kind of view foreign missions as a planting a church. And by that, we mean really a denomination where we don't have a presbytery. And then home missions is planting churches and establishing churches where we do have presbyteries. And then Christian Ed is establishing and supporting churches where we already have local congregations, right? So like building up the existing local congregations. So all three of those committees are effectively doing the exact same thing according to the Great Commission, which is to make disciples of men and baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and then teaching them to do everything that he's commanded us to do. And so you see, well, how do we carry out the Great Commission? Well, you do the same activity. You make disciples, you baptize and teach. And that looks a little bit different depending on if you have a local church or if you don't, or if you don't even have a regional church. But effectively, you're all doing the same thing. And then Reform Forum merely steps in not to replace any of that. And we don't do the Great Commission ourselves. That's the church's role. But we step in and try to help where we can be helpful by sending teachers to go teach in Colombia, providing resources, publishing books, articles, having conversations on theology, having courses and stuff like that, and making them available for ministers of the gospel and people working in churches to be able to carry out their God-given responsibilities within the context of his body, the church. And to me, it just seems like a encouraging way to think about it, an encouraging way to go forward with this work, rather than stepping on toes and say, well, we want to have our own institute here, so we want the church to back off, and we want to, you know, expand our brand into another country or something like that. It doesn't have to be a competition, and it shouldn't be a competition when we're all aligned correctly and thinking in biblical categories.
Yeah, that's right. We're you know, at Reform Forum, we're seeking to aid the church precisely in its mission to the great, the Great Commission, to fulfill the Great Commission. That's, you know, it's going to look different in other ways, but we at Reform Forum dare not try to do the work of the church. We're not Absolutely. The church, and we're very, very clear, very self-conscious about that. It's the church that carries out the Great Commission of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're here to offer resources that we believe will be of use and of help yeah. to the church.
Amen. So, Ann, there's a lot going on there. We're very thankful for what you've done. Jim, I'd like to talk to you more about some ways that we can capture or develop much of your Van Til material. Hopefully, I don't want to put anything on your shoulders, but maybe down the road we could have another curriculum or something, another class course in our curriculum where you could teach the stuff and our listeners and viewers would be able to follow along as well.
Yeah, I would love to do that. I think, you know, as there are a couple of things that I tried to bring out in the course of the lectures that I'm not sure are always very well set forth by people who are articulating Van Til's perspective. And I already covered the one, which is the pastoral cover, the pastoral aspect. I think that really is sort of a macro motif, as it were, that really everything that Van Til did and said needs to be understood in that context of being a pastor, even though he wasn't a pastor like we think of a pastor,
For a year
established in mm-hmm. a pulpit somewhere, you know.
He was, but just for a year.
What's that?
He was, but only for a year.
Yeah, that's right. He was for a time, but generally that's not the way we think of him. We think of him as a professor in the classroom and a writer of books and all that. we rarely think of him in terms of his role as a minister, and that's really what he saw himself as. He saw himself as a minister who was going to serve Christ and his sheep. But the second thing is the absolute essential nature of the Trinity for his approach to apologetics.
Again, that's so essential.
Yeah, that's something that doesn't always come out in all the material that's out there. Of course, the exception would be Dr. Tipton's dissertation that he wrote on Van Til, which is, just magisterial. Mm-hmm. But setting forth Van Til's doctrine of the Trinity, which is really the work that set me on this understanding of the role of the Trinity in Van Til's theology, which ended up affecting his approach to apologetics. And that takes me to the third thing that isn't said nearly enough, which is that in order to understand Van Til and his method to apologetics, you have to understand what he was doing, which is trying to bring his theology, Reformed theology, in line with apologetics, so that we don't have, let's say, a Reformed theology and then an Arminian approach to apologetics.
Precisely.
which is the way that he, tagged, for instance, mm-hmm. Butler and others.
Gerstner,
The whole night, the evidentialist classical approach, mm-hmm. which, even by Reformed people, like in old Princeton, you've got Abraham Kuyper, where you've got these solid Reform guys, but then when it goes to the question of how we engage the unbeliever, it kind of falls apart and you fall into a method that's more keeping it with Arminianism than Reform theology. So Van Til wanted to make sure that that our theology, our Reform theology, and our approach to apologetic did sweetly comply. So those were the three things I tried to hammer home throughout the course of the week.
Well, I appreciate that. I've always thought that the Trinity is so central to Van Til's writing, and you find it front and center in Introduction to Systematic Theology, which is a course syllabus that eventually got developed and published as a book. But there you find and see how foundational this is. And that's something you find like folks like John Frame will talk about Van Til's doctrine of the Trinity, but not develop it certainly to the extent or apply it as much as Van Til did, and certainly not as much as what you find in works like Lane Tipton's. But then you also find Frame, who's really weak on the transcendental argument and its uniqueness. You find Bahnsen, for example, is really strong on the unique nature of the transcendental argument and method, but almost, doesn't speak at all about the Trinity or how that applies to Van Til's apologetic. And so you have to have both, The Trinity needs to be addressed, and we have to understand what Van Til meant by how the persons relate, his doctrine of perichoresis, his understanding of equal ultimacy. All of these things are so critical, and I echo your thoughts that Lane's dissertation really set me off on my own research as well, and so that features and factors in a large measure in my dissertation on Rahner. And what should be out as the Rahner Great Thinkers book, hopefully at the end by the fall of this year, that's a big feature in there. Same thing with the chapter that I wrote in the Verne Poitras Festschrift. Van Til is utterly important. He's really advancing things in a helpful, orthodox way when we understand what he's actually doing.
Just a quick funny story, and I'll wrap things up with this, but you mentioned the idea of equal ultimacy, and of course Van Til talks about equal ultimacy in terms of the Trinity, the persons and the oneness, the threeness and the oneness of God, the one and the many, equally ultimate. And I didn't know it at the time, but apparently there's no English or Spanish translation of that expression. And
I'm sure there are a few. Concrete Universal, you could probably come up with one, but I'm sure there are a handful of Van Til-isms that are not available in Espanol.
I absolutely stubbed the translators with that one. And I didn't mean to. I just, it was that expression I used. And we're doing our rhythm, I would say something, the interpreter would translate, and then I said equal ultimacy, and then it was like dead silence. there was no expression that they have readily at hand to articulate that, and so we had to figure out an end around around that expression.
But if you want to see your computer smoke, I recommend you pasting a chapter of Van Til into Google Translate and see what happens. Or at least the Google Cloud will start to screech to a halt as millions of whatever teraflops start to try to understand what he was getting after. That's crazy. Well, I appreciate that, Jim. I look forward to talking more about this and seeing how we can develop some of these themes and this course into something that's accessible and usable for a wide English-speaking audience, and hopefully also maybe we can get over the long term. We definitely want to turn our attention to developing more resources in other languages, particularly in Spanish, because we know there's a huge need for good Reformed literature and books in Spanish, Chinese. You know, there's some other languages we'd like to get to at some point. We got a few minutes left just in our loose conversation here, so I'd like to follow up and just get a little, give you both an opportunity to talk a little bit about what you've been reading lately. And I'll kick stuff off because it's on point. But in preparation for going down to Colombia, I'm trying to develop a couple more lectures for the Reformed Theology and Roman Catholicism class. And I want to expand on the theology of liberation. And so I've been reading a book by Gustavo Gutierrez, the foundational book, A Theology of Liberation here. It was written in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. The 11th printing that I have is 1984. It was originally published in Lima in 1971. And Gutierrez is often seen as kind of like the founder of liberation theology. What happened is Vatican II occurred in 1962 to 1965, I believe. And then after Vatican II, with all the new documents, declarations, constitutions, the Catholic Church charged all the local churches or local regions to take and apply Vatican II theology to their particular context. So Karl Rahner wrote a book about maybe some of the German entailments of this. He wrote a book called The Shape of the Church to Come, which is a fascinating book, and it really discloses his kind of idea of church authority and kind of a modernist revelation. But for the Central Latin America context, there was a conference held in Medellin, which is a city in Colombia, very well known because a cartel started there, the Medellin cartel. Pablo Escobar's cartel was in Medellin. So that's how I always remember after watching Narcos. But you see this conference was held, and then they sought to apply Vatican II theology for their context. And in large measure, they were trying to deal with the issue of the complete disparity between the prosperous and those in power and the average person in the pews and the average person in the country. And so they rejected, eventually Gutierrez developed a theology that began to reject the status quo and this idea of development by, you know, economic development and whatnot, because it was perpetually keeping the poor and underprivileged in, you know, a condition of oppression and whatnot. And so he kind of wedded Vatican II theology to a Marxist philosophy and developed what's called liberation theology. And that has since been used in a variety of different contexts, you know, whether that be in certain subgenres of African-American theology and whatnot, have developed a theology of liberation as liberation from racial injustice and whatnot. And so there's some helpful things to read in terms of Gutierrez to help to understand how they understand the Bible and the relationship between God's justice and what they see as political and social injustice. So one thing that he develops in the book I thought was really fascinating, especially for someone who's read a lot of Karl Rahner, is the idea of love of God and love of neighbor and how those two are connected. So for Rahner, love of God and love of neighbor are effectively the same thing. And so to love God, you must love your neighbor. He thinks of the two great commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. But he doesn't want to think of those as two disconnected things or things done in two different arenas, because loving neighbor is a form of loving God because he's commanded us to do that. There's a whole host of reasons that Rahner understands this. There are a lot of existentialist reasons and kind of Heideggerian ontology behind his reason for understanding this. But at least in a formal level, we could say that love of God and love of neighbor are not discrete, separate, you know, disjuncted activities. So we can agree at a formal level that that's all right. But what's interesting is that Gutierrez takes this and says, not only is love of neighbor, love of God, and love of God, love of neighbor, that is, to love God, we must love our neighbor. But he seems to suggest and demonstrate that love of neighbor, and therefore also love of God, must be mediated through particular socio-cultural and socio-political institutions. And so to love your neighbor is not necessarily a matter of personal private conscience, that you must love your neighbor in a way that accords with God's prompting in your life and according to your conscience, but you have to love your neighbor in a particularly Marxist way, you know? To love your neighbor means very specific things in terms of political decisions as well. And so that, to me, seemed to be the very nugget of the whole book and the whole movement, is this mediation of love of neighbor through particular ideas of and particular understandings of socio-political and socio-cultural forms and institutions. So I'll leave it at that and say it's definitely a classic of 20th century Christian theology. I won't say that it's a book that I could stand with and agree with at many points, but definitely a book well worth reading and worth wrestling with, and a book that'll raise a lot of questions. And I find the value of a book is, if I find myself challenged and constantly wanting to talk back to the book, you know what I mean? You guys ever read a book and you're saying, yeah, but what about this? What about, and writing in the margins? To me, that's a book I want to read. It, you know, not just a book that's telling me everything I already know or everything I already agree with, but a book that's going to challenge me. And Gustavo Gutierrez's Theology of Liberation is definitely one of those. I've been reading a couple others, but I'll leave it at that for now. Have you guys been reading anything that's been challenging you?
Well, Camden, maybe that would be a good, I think, segue to mention a book that I had the opportunity of reading pretty recently, and that's Alan Strange's book on the doctrine of the spirituality of the church mm-hmm. and the ecclesiology of Charles Hodge, which is a fascinating book. And Strange focuses specifically on how the Presbyterian Church in the 19th century, in the years leading up to, during, and immediately after the Civil War, were struggling with that doctrine and how it relates to the church and the church's relationship specifically to the state and the union in particular, and whether or not the church should support the union. And it's a helpful book, not only historically for understanding the history of the doctrine of the spirituality of the church and the Presbyterian Church in the USA in particular, but just for understanding the bigger picture of what is the mission of the church, what has Christ called the church to do, and how does the church relate to culture, society, to the state, and so on. It's a very helpful book.
That's fascinating. You know, I loved reading that book myself, and I did find it to be a challenging book, but it's the kind of book you could read many times over and think about all the implications and things therein. One thing I remember from reading that book was his treatment of the history regarding the Gardner Spring Resolution, mm-hmm. which had to do with, I believe, slave ownership and whatnot, and whether the Presbyterian Church was going to make a stand or discuss whether that was permissible, especially in the South. And so that was called to mind recently because I just finished reading Jamar Tisby's book, The Color of Compromise, which is another book that I enjoyed reading, but another book that challenged me and a book that I was constantly having a conversation with and writing in the margins as I read that and wrestled with many of the ideas and suggestions. So that's another book, a brand new book. That one's published by Zondervan, just came out a couple weeks ago. But Alan Strange, that you can find our interview with him in the archives, and that's well worth listening to.
Yeah, two interviews, actually, on CTC.
That's right.
One before the book was published after the book was published.
Yeah, one was more largely focusing on a Mid-America Journal article, I think, but it was on the same subject, stuff that's in correct. The book, yeah, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I am reviewing the book for New Horizons, and that should come out very soon. And it's a review article. And I'm also writing a review article for Ordained Servant 2, and I'm focusing there specifically on the eschatology of Charles Hodge and how that affected his doctrine of the spirituality of the church.
That's good. What about you, Jim? You've been steeped in Bart and Van Til forever. Do you read anything else anymore?
I try not to. Yeah, a couple of things. I just finished last month, The God of Hope, which is a collection of Van Til's
sermon. Yeah, I don't even have that. I feel so woefully inadequate.
Because it's out of print. But if you can find it somewhere on Amazon or whatnot.
What's growing out of the side of that book?
Those are my tabs to, you know, go
back.
I
was wondering, it looked like a pop-up book.
Ooh, a dinosaur.
Remind me of our friend Matt Patton, who refuses to write in his books, but he uses those sticky notes and tabs.
I write in my book and I tab them.
Looks like it's grown colored fur.
I know. I don't know. Anyway, this is just picked this up recently too. Some of the articles in here I've been reading. There you go, Glenn.
For the listeners, The Essential Writings of Meredith Klein, hardcover.
Yes. Oh yeah, I forgot that we got listeners. I got to say what the book is. And then also, I'm just about done with this, but another hard to find volume, The Analogy of Being, edited by Thomas Joseph White, who is a priest. It's a collection of essays on Barth's expression that the analogia entis is the invention of the Antichrist. And so stimulating.
Tell us what you really think. Oh,
yeah,
man.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Barth was known for, you know. Well, the interesting thing is later on, you know, he says at the beginning of CD 1-1, and then later on he says something to the effect of the people who despise scholasticism are of the Antichrist. You know, so you know, he wants his scholastic cake and also to eat it as well. So
oh man. Well, I got another one, Glenn. I think you have this book, or at least maybe we've discussed it, but it's Conformed to the Image of His Son, Reconsidering Paul's Theology of Glory in Romans. It's written by Haley Goranson Jacob. She's a professor of theology out in Spokane, Washington. I apologize. I'm forgetting the name of the institution, but it's affiliated with the Mainline Presbyterian Church. This book's published by IVP, and it has a foreword by N.T. Wright. So it's focusing largely on Romans 8:29, which is a really important verse. And but you know, not only that, but largely the hope of glory in Romans 5-8, but it really diving down into Romans 8:28-30, and particularly that 29th verse, to speak about what does it mean to be conformed to the image of his son so that Christ would be the firstborn of many brothers. That's one of my favorite verses to think about, and especially in light of Paul's theology of glorification. What does it mean then to be glorified? And she's advocating a new interpretation that's been suggested by a couple people, but it has never been developed. And just I'm still very early in the book, but I'm gaining a good survey of where she's headed with the argument, and she's advocating a functional view. That is that the glorification is not first and foremost sanctification or radiant light or ethical conformity or anything of that sort, but it has to do with participating in and sharing in Christ's exalted status as Lord over creation. Let me read you a little section. It says, "His visible splendor is figurative imagery that connotes his power or character or status. Put another way, the visible splendor of God, as in glory or kavod, doxa, does not connote the presence of God, but the presence of a particular God with particular attributes and who acts in the world in particular ways." She develops that over and over again and does very long, extended treatments of the use of the words doxazo and doxa and kavod in the scriptures. And it's a challenging book. It's well worth the read thus far. I'm not even halfway, but I don't even think I'm going out on a limb, but saying this is definitely worth picking up and reading, especially if you are trying to understand the theology of the book of Romans, which we all would do well to do.
Very interesting. That's a really interesting thesis, particularly when you think about how the glorification of Christ and his resurrection and exaltation is tied in with his humiliation and exaltation.
Right.
Suffering which leads unto glory, and our present suffering in union with him, which also leads to glory. And that reminds me, Camden, of another book I'm reading and just finished it, actually, which I think is very helpful in terms of eschatology. And that's The Promise of the Future by Cornelis Venema.
Absolutely.
Published by Banner of Truth. Nice hardback book.
Big fat one. Yeah.
A big fat one. Yeah. And a very, very well written, thorough, and very helpful as far as laying out the different views of eschatology and assessing them biblically. And Venema, I think, makes a very good, compelling case for amillennialism.
Yes. Well, he's a superb theologian, and I'm sure that that book is definitely well worth the time to read it, but well worth the price to have it on your shelf as well. I do not have a copy myself, so I'm going to have to go get one here very, very soon. But that's an important recommendation. Any other books to mention right out of the gate or before we close up here? I know there's so much. My to-read list continues to grow faster than my have-read list.
I know. Or can-read list,
can
right?
Can-read list, yeah.
Exactly, right.
There you go.
Yeah, just real quick, this is the second edition of Christian Theistic Evidences that's come out. This is actually my first time working through this. This is one of the few volumes of Van Til's that I actually haven't read yet until now. It's just excellent. He goes through, he takes that first chapter and he's dissecting Bishop Butler's analogy.
Right.
And it's absolutely masterful. Anybody who says that Van Til didn't take his time to sit down and to actually learn, and to absorb and to, really process the theology of the person they were critiquing, needs to pick up this book because it'll put that thesis to the
right.
lie. He just digs into Butler. He lets Butler speak. He doesn't criticize him as he's going along at every turn. He sets up Butler's views using extensive quotation from his work, and it just shows that he was as good of a historical theologian as he was an apologist.
He really was. I guess I'll just add for the listeners, one of the things I've seen so often with critics of Van Til is this failure to acknowledge or even to understand the difference between what someone says explicitly and what the necessary entailments of their theology are. Mm-hmm. And Van Til so frequently not only addresses what the person says, but then tries to understand it on its own terms and then draw out the necessary theological and philosophical entailments of such a view. And so people say, well, so-and-so never says that they're irrationalists. Well, of course they don't say that they are, but when they're working out the theology, when we stand on the opponent's foundation for the sake of the argument and then work with it and demonstrate the absurdity therein and how it crumbles under its own presuppositions, then we're doing a service here by demonstrating these things and carrying them out to their necessary conclusions. But so frequently, people that misunderstand Van Til's method or misunderstand what he's doing in polemics is because people can't understand the distinction or refuse to acknowledge the distinction between somebody's express views and the proper necessary entailments of those express views. So I just encourage people who are reading to read very patiently and to understand kind of Van Til's method and how he works out his polemic in that way.
Yes, and it's not an uncharitable thing to do.
Oh, no, it's the good and necessary consequences. Maybe not always good in terms of the consequences that they arrive at, but this is just using your brain and to demonstrate on someone's own terms and charitably where such a view goes, not in a slippery slope fallacy way, but in terms of the necessary consequences of someone's views.
It is the most charitable thing to do if your aim is to protect Christ's little ones.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's precisely correct. And actually, it's those who would say, no, we have to stick to the surface, right? You know, I mean, that's what people who criticize Van Til's critique of Bart, for instance, have to say. Well, you know, you have to deal with Bart on his own terms. Yes, we do. Absolutely, we do. But we cannot just stay with the language that Bart uses. That's just surfacey scholarship and surfacey reading. What we need to do is to be able to penetrate into the deep underpinnings of the man's thought and then show how those underpinnings necessarily entail certain conclusions. And that's what Van Til did, which actually, I believe, shows him and manifests him to be one of the most deep and penetrating interpreters of Bart that there ever was.
Yeah.
Disagree with Van Til's, you know, conclusions and his critique of Bart, that's fine. But you know what? If you read him carefully, you can't conclude that he did not penetrate into the man's thought carefully and deeply.
Mm. Well, I'll end with this. I mean, he was one of the first English interpreters of Bart, published The New Modernism, I think, in 1946. I've been trying to track down a first edition of one of those. I and Ryan Noah both have 47 editions, and you guys probably have one too, but I'll tell you, and I'll gloat before you, I just snagged a first edition Christianity and Bartianism, a 1962. At least that's what the entry said on abebooks.com. Nice. So I'm hoping when it arrives that it lives up to the billing and it is indeed what they said it is. But that'll be a nice one. I don't have a hardcover of Christianity and Bartianism, so I'm looking to having one of those. Trying to add one more to the set.
And by the way, Van Til was one of the first, if not the first, American interpreters of Bart who was reading Bart in the original German, before even the English sure. translations came out. Mm-hmm. So, and if you look at his citations that he has in the New Modernism and also in Christianity and Bartianism, you'll see that there are references to the KD, not the CD. So, yep. I mean,
his copies are still in the Westminster Library in the special collections room.
And you can see the marginalia where he's with hand. As you were saying, he was talking back to the book.
Yep.
As he's reading Bart. And there's sort of this out there, the simple dismissal of Van Til as if he didn't know what he was doing. But if you actually read Van Til, which most people who critique Van Til's interpretation of Bart haven't done, but if you actually read Van Til, you find out that he did work.
Yeah, but the question is, did he have all those sticky notes around his editions of Bart? Did he turn it into a pop-up book?
It was most certainly before the time of the Post-it. That's for sure.
Yeah, the Post-it. Yeah, he predates the Post-it. Thank goodness. Oh man. Well, it's been a fun conversation, guys. Thanks for taking the time to pop onto the conference call and talk about these important things. And Jim, thanks so much for your service to Christ Church going down to Columbia. Look forward to all of the fruits
of that.
No, the
honor was mine. It was a privilege.
I know. But we're thankful for your service.
And those videos, Camden, by the way, are still
Oh, yes. Available. Yes, they live streamed streamed the videos on Facebook. We'll do what I can to collect those and include those in the episode description so people can mm-hmm. click on those. And you might even share them with some folks. If you have friends or family who speak in Espanol, then you can share those recordings with them and they can hear about Van Til in their mother tongue. And very much we can sympathize with the translator, not only is trying to understand Jim's New Jersey accent, but also communicate Van Tilian terms through a New
Double
Jersey
whammy.
Accent. Yeah. Yeah. We feel es muy difícil. Ay, ay, ay. This is not an easy task, but we're thankful for that. So muchas gracias, Jimbo.
Thank you.
CC. I want to point people back to the website. Of course, reformedforum.org is where you're going to find everything. And we're firing up some video now. We got a Vimeo account again. I'm going to start using that again. But you can find our videos at vimeo.com/reformedforum starting now moving forward. You can also find, ever since we've been doing the videos now since last summer, find copies of them at Facebook on our Facebook page as well as youtube.com/reformedforum. I encourage you to subscribe there and then you can get those videos automatically popping up in your account when you log in. But of course, we have audio versions. That's our bread and butter. And so you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe on Google Play and whatever Stitcher, whatever podcast directory you use, we should be in there. So thanks so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.